thoughts from last week.
And specifically, did any of you do anything during this week that I challenged you to
at
the end of class last week?
I thought about it.
Well, thinking about it is a help.
We discussed it. We couldn't come up with a good idea how to go about
how to do it within our community or something.
You mean more than what we do?
Well, because I was thinking, like, we do all those dinners. How could we do? I don't think I have a real feel for. It feels awkward. I don't know how to think about it even, really, in order, an act of kindness, but, just how it really works, Like how they do it anyway.
Right.
Because we do, we have angels and people are very, I think, generous in this community. I was wondering why people don't show up to dinners. Is it because they can't afford it? Or they're uncomfortable, for all those dinners.
And yeah, then we talk about that we...
Maybe they just don't want to.
We typically get 30-plus people at everything, and we have a community of 45 to 55, so we have a huge...
You look at churches across the board, participation in the kind of activities you're describing tends to run about 10 or 15% of the community. And we get close to half, and sometimes more.
And more, yeah.
So, I mean, the fact that it's a small crowd is because we're a small crowd.
Right.
Community.
Not within this...
The other piece of a more organized we had talked about before, and it's what the what's it called, the bank, Larry? What's the
hour
bank? That kind of a thing where you could we could make a more organized process of we even do some of that just word of mouth and such, but we could have an organized, like, I'll give, I'll walk dogs for somebody who, and you trade off skills and such.
Right.
Which is a...
And it feels like it would come from a need. And I think it would work better if people, like we were saying, there's people in our community that have certain passions, right? If people are working with the homeless or the kitchens, right?
And the vets.
That's all great, and the vets and everything. So I think it has to be like a homegrown thing like that, for it to really work, doesn't it? If somebody has the idea.
Well, you're focusing, I think, maybe a little too much on what I'd call quasi-organized kind of activities. Little things that you do for somebody who doesn't even necessarily know you did them. I don't think those are that complicated, but I think we tend to overcomplicate them. And part of the reason for this, and we were talking about that on the way home last week, is that people don't react well to gifts.
Right. Yeah. It's hard for people to receive.
It's hard for people to receive gifts and compliments in our culture.
Okay.
Yep. Right? So you go do something for somebody, you face the risk that they're going to turn around and say, I didn't need that.
Yeah.
What do I look like, a poor person to you? Whatever kind of response you might get.
Right.
So some of that also comes to bear. But if you just do stuff, maybe you don't want to hang around while it's going on. It's these ideas of prepaying the person behind you's toll and a cup of coffee in line, all that stuff, those are fine. But those are the person's physically present. And, it's like, maybe not. And they don't know how they're going to react to it. But stuff that you do completely anonymously, I was thinking, for example, last week I was thinking that if somebody said, I'm going to walk along, I almost said University Avenue, which is the main street in Palo Alto, but I'll walk along Alvarado, and I'm going to pick up trash around those little bins, the trash bins they've got around there, and just put it in the trash bin. Just walk along, just do that. Walk along the whole street and do that, because there's always stuff laying there. And I'm not going to make it a big deal out of that. I'm not going to talk to anybody. I'm doing it for somebody. I'm doing it for the good of the community. Just little tiny stuff like that doesn't take a lot of extra time or effort, but you can demonstrate and in yourself the idea of charity and gifting and giftivism in so many ways.
See, I got raised that way. Something's on the ground, you pick it up and throw it away. Whenever I wash my hands in a public restroom, I always wipe off all the counters. I always push the garbage can down because people just throw their and it's overflowing and you just push down and it there's more room.
Yep.
And I just grew up, that's just what you do.
That's the idea, right?
Yeah.
But a lot now aren't brought up that way.
That's true.
So they don't know
And I think like we have to model it for them.
Right. Another thing that I've noticed that, and I'm sure you've seen this with the homeless vets that you deal with, is that there are a lot of homeless vets who stand on street corners here with signs. And I don't always have money that I could give them, but I always stop and roll down the window and say, hi, have a good day, or God bless you, or thanks for your service, or something like that. And it lights them up.
Yeah.
My little granddaughter, Maddie, will be in the back seat. She just thinks homeless people are the greatest thing on the planet. So we should help them all. We should take them home to us. Can we take them home and give them some lunch? He's going, he's hungry. Yeah, kind of thing. So the other day we drove by this one homeless guy across from the Safeway up there, and he was talking to her. The back seat, back window was rolled down. They were talking. I'm trying to make my turn, and they're having a chat. You know, about what's up? I mean, so just even acknowledging somebody. I can tell you a story that I was going to use later, but I'll use it now because it's an example of what we're talking about. This is apparently a true story. There was a woman walking. Well, there was a guy who was really despondent, and he was on the Golden Gate Bridge. And he was walking along the Golden Gate Bridge, and he was crying. And there was a lot of people around, and people weren't paying attention to him. And he was just in tears. And he got partway across the bridge, and a woman came up and said, would you take my picture? He said, sir. So she took her picture, handed her the camera back, took three running steps, and jumped off the bridge. Now, he survived the fall. So after the fact, we talked to this guy, and he says, if one person on that bridge had smiled at me, I wouldn't have jumped.
Wouldn't have
jumped. One person had smiled at me, but everybody was just looking away and ignoring him. And so you can see he was crying, but people were just, I don't want to get involved.
Even the woman who asked exactly. him to take a picture,
she didn't
really acknowledge
it. I know you're really upset here, but could you take my picture? it was just, that was a very moving story for me. Because we don't acknowledge the people around us. We tend to walk around with our eyes down, especially now with these devices we've got in our hands, right? Walking around texting all the time or watching baseball games or whatever we're doing. On our eyes down devices, we're walking around. We're not even making eye contact with people on the same street.
Well, that's what a lot of the homeless is like, do you see me?
Exactly. Right.
You know,
yeah.
Don't look through me.
Right.
Nod of the head.
Right, exactly.
Acknowledge you are a person. You are a being.
Right.
A lot of times, even people that give money to homeless don't look.
That's right.
They just sort of, as opposed to making a point. Yeah, we've talked about that a number of times, of actually making eye contact and acknowledging them and having a human exchange. Yeah.
It makes sometimes that's just knowing that somebody notices them makes a huge difference. A little act of kindness.
So that was what I was talking about when I talked about these kinds of acts of kindness, not organized things that you have to figure out how do we solve this problem or get to that solution or whatever, but just little things that we can do in the course of just walking around and living for other people that they may or may not even recognize or acknowledge or understand or receive.
It's interesting when you, here we have a community, but I don't know how many of you have felt like a part of a community. I know when we went to ministerial school, this group of people, we were not necessarily all people that we would be friends with normally, but we were all thrown into this same thing together. And the connection of if anybody needed, Marie and I remember we had the flu one time when we were both home sick with the flu, and then we heard this noise, and they'd come over, just four or five of our classmates had come over with a snowblower and cleared our driveway because it was covered with snow and such, and everybody always helped people move. It was an interesting experience because we don't get that very often anymore of a community that's more than your family, a community of people that have a connection and.
I spoke with
and that happens here. So
once and stopped and started talking with him, and interesting. I probably but. I was talking, I'm thinking, wow, I didn't really need your life story, but okay, because I really got it. I know a lot about him. And as I was kind of getting ready to leave, I said, I don't have any money. I wish I had some to give. He goes, no, you already gave me your gift. Mm-hmm. And I think what he meant was, you talked with me.
Yeah. Acknowledged me.
There are obviously many people are very much hungry for dialogue.
Just human connection.
Yeah. Well,
it was
pretty funny, though.
I took those things to a second chance yesterday, and I saw some flower pots, some big flower pots that I wanted to buy, and I was going to give them to my mother-in-law. And I wasn't going to give them to her. I was just going to bring them to the house and leave them there. Because, it's like you said, it's kind of hard to give something. But they wouldn't sell them to me because they said they hadn't priced them yet. So I went in and got the manager. I said, I want those flower pots, because you price them. They wouldn't price them. So he said the person that pulled the price on will be back at 1 o'clock.
Oh,
so I waited till 1, and they said, "Well, we got to start on this end, and then we'll work our way down."
Oh my
goodness! So I went back today to get them, and they were gone.
Oh
and
no!
And that same lady that told me that she couldn't do it, she said, "Oh no, those things go like hotcakes." I was like, "Yeah, I know. I wanted one. You wouldn't sell it to me." But anyway, that was going to be my thing. But I wasn't really thinking about that. That's what I do with her. I get flower pots because I know that they're all into horticulture and all that. And I leave them around the house, and then they're happy to see them.
Like the flower
pot. I've done that before. I wanted these because these were long. They really would have liked those.
See, that's a really good example of the kind of thing we're talking about, I think, in week one. Organizations that are in the business of trying to help people get hung up in all of these bureaucratic bull crap and procedures and turf wars, and so just like a corporation, and they end up stymieing their own mission. It happens all the time.
I had them on my truck. I actually was I had unloaded all the stuff from the church, and I saw them over, and I put them on my truck, and then I decided to go over and ask. And when I, because I could have drove off, and I decided to go ask, and they said, "No, you can't do it." And so then I took them off of my truck, and I left. After I waited around, and I got about like three people, and the one guy was like, "He already asked two people, asking the third, and he told that lady, we already told him that he couldn't have him." He's the one. Well,
yeah.
Is alone.
Maybe one of them wanted them.
Jeez.
Well, we have lots of those kinds of examples, and then we get so that we expect that, as opposed to expecting and being part of creating alternatives. So I guess for me, the other part is to catch myself when I get caught in the rules or the whatever, as opposed to making something, making it work.
Well, see, if that kind of place was set up on a gifting basis, right? They would just say, "Go ahead and take them, and if you feel like giving something to us or somebody else."
Yeah, he just brought a whole truckload of stuff to them. I mean, everything that was here, he had just taken to them.
I think they would have been fine if I would have driven
on. Yeah, probably so, yeah.
Remember
the old adage, it's easier to get forgiveness than permission.
Yeah, any other thoughts?
Passed this car and it looked like this man was sleeping in there. He had a bunch of clothes and out of state. And I was like, I wonder if I should buy him a sandwich. That would meet the requirement. And then I just felt so awkward. And he had his windows rolled up, and I was like, well, what kind of sandwich does he want? I don't know. Maybe I should just make one up and give it to him. And I don't know. Maybe what he really needs is a place to stay. Well, I don't want him staying at my house.
I think I'm sure you've heard the story, but just in case you haven't, Neil Donald Walsh, you know who he is. When he was homeless, before he became famous spiritual teacher and writer and author, was living in Seattle. He was walking down the street one day, and he had in his pocket a $5 bill and 28 cents. And that was going to get him through the day to get his lunch and so forth. That was all the money he had in the world. And he starts, came along the street, and he sees this woman panhandling. And he says, as he's approaching her, he's thinking, I should give her something. I mean, I haven't got much, but I should give her something. I'll give her this 28 cents that I got in my pocket. And he reached in and took the 28 cents, had them in his hand. He thought, that's pretty cheap. I mean, that's not trusting in a God to do things right. So I'm gonna give her the $5 bill. And then his voice said, if you give her the $5 bill, you're not going to have anything to eat for lunch, you dummy. You can't give her the $5 bill. So he had this internal debate with himself as he walked past her and didn't give her anything. He laughs about it all the time, but we do that. It's just that exactly kind of thing you're talking about. We start second guessing and getting in our own way, and
I think I'll have more courage next time to start a conversation
I've done
like,
that.
Hey, would it help? Yeah. You know, are you hungry? Can I buy you lunch? Or maybe I'll.
And I wouldn't worry about what kind of sandwich you want. So if he's hungry, he'll eat what he's whatever kind of sandwich you bring him. You
know he's like, what? No, I'm a vegan.
Right. Yeah.
Listen, could you give me some curly fries instead of those straight ones? I really.
You work up to it because I've run into that and then I felt guilty about it.
Yeah.
But what I do is if I see somebody and I'm afraid to do something right there, the next time I go do it, or I'm less afraid.
Because you've thought about it in the meantime
create
a plan.
So I've gradually, because I was scared of homeless at one time, mm-hmm. and I think it's probably in me that's saying, well, that could be you, and that's absolutely right. Mm-hmm. And so I have gone up more and more to people, and one time I just watched somebody, and I thought, maybe I should give this person a ride, but I didn't do it. But I'm so aware now of what's around me, so if I can do something, I try to, like, if I don't do it that time, I try to push myself next time to do something. But I don't feel guilty about it anymore. I just keep going a little bit more forward.
Well, the thing is we often don't even think about it. So a class like this, and you start thinking about a really shifting our whole perception and such, it starts being there. So now you notice and eventually you change your behavior and you keep thinking about, and well, that worked out and what else could I do? And so that's sort of the journey.
I look when I first started to where I am now and it's much better. You know, if I see somebody playing at the wharf and they've got something out where they put money, a lot of times I don't pass by now. I just go and sit there and listen to a song and put something in and then I go. Or like, you say you smile, or you say how you doing today, that kind of thing, because everybody wants that connection. I do. So it's like it's, you know, so I'm better at it than I used to.
What do you do with a person, though? I guess it's honesty. I really need the money to go get a drink. Have you seen that sign down there? That's what made me think of it.
There's
a guy that's
that
down
one.
There says, yeah, I just want a beer.
Boy, he's been
I saw that one, yeah, right, yeah.
So I don't know what to think about that.
My position on that has always been, I'm not going to ask you what you're using it for.
Yeah,
I'm giving you because I want to give you. Whatever you do with it is fine. I mean, if you're screwing up your life, you're like, somebody else is going to give it to you anyway. I'm not going to worry about that.
And we're not helping.
That's what my...
Yeah, on some level, but it's like, you know.
I mean, that's
I'm going to give you, give you enough for one
am
beer. I'm probably
that,
not going to kill you.
That's what my...
Or am I, you know, going to feel good because I gave or...
This,
you know, I mean,
this
minister, I had that debate.
When we had that discussion in school, and he said, you know, same thing you did. He says, mine's to give. Mine isn't to make judgments or decisions for the other person. It's mine to give. And, you know, if they're hungry, they'll buy food. If they want to drink, they're going to buy it, whatever. But that's not my concern. That doesn't mean, you know, a dollar, they're not going to get much.
I'm going to get too drunk on a buck.
But
I've tried.
That's just where I had to go to because you don't know what they're going to do with it. And otherwise, it's that same conversation of all these judgments about what they might do with it. And
yeah. You know, we might be the one gift that says open something up to them.
That's right.
Hey, you don't know.
You never know.
It's
our intention.
After last week when you guys talked about that, I had the very next day, it was just perfectly timed. I ran into a guy that I had already planned on helping, so it's not one of these things where he won't know who we are, because he does. But my mom and I have befriended this taxi driver, and he's a young Afghanistan guy with a wife and a kid, a toddler, and he has a brother who also has a wife and a toddler. And they're in this country, and their mother is 75 years old. She's stuck in Afghanistan because she speaks some dialect that no one in the consulate understands. No one in the American embassy understands. And so they've tried and tried to get her here, and my mom and I said, we're going to help you. You know, we're going to help you do this. And so then I talked to his brother on the phone. His brother's been 5 years at DLI, which is high status here. His brother is a medical doctor back in Afghanistan, which
And I took down all the information, and we talked and everything, and he felt much better. And then the next time we talked, I said, just have you just emailed the consulate yet and let them know who you are and what you are and what mm-hmm. you're doing and what the whole problem is. Just your mom doesn't speak the dialect. But he's going to cover her in every way financially. So in every way, she should be here. And I just said to him on the phone, I said, we're not going to stop until your mother is on a plane to California. You know, and that's it. So it's not one of these ones where the person didn't know about it. But, I mean, it's really very pressing to me because I know it can be done, and I know we can help them do it. And so that's what happened.
Very cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Consider going to Sam Farr or his replacement.
Mm-hmm. You know, he did that. Oh, even okay. Sam Farr wasn't able to pull it off. But I know it can be pulled off. I know it.
Jimmy Panetta.
I'll let you know when it comes through.
I was going to say, yeah.
Yeah, Jimmy wants some good PR.
He needs some good PR.
I'll let you know when it comes through.
So we've done the first week, the principles were law of mind action and the universal law of substance, infinite substance, that everybody feel pretty comfortable with both of those principles, what they're about. Week two, he called a Butterworth named Law of Consciousness, which is basically the same as the Law of Mind Action, except that it's looking at sort of as I interpreted it, it's sort of the collective of how we're showing up, where Law of Mind Action is, you know, our thoughts create an experience, but our consciousness in general has more to do with what, like Lynn Twist was talking about, sort of as I'm interpreting it, our whole orientation towards life. So what are we living from? And so he talked about it's living from the inside out. And that's, I mean, they're the same principle, but slightly different. And this week, the reading talked about, I think we're moving more into tools. He's calling them laws, but they're actually more tools than laws, I think. And so he talks about the law of visualization, which, again, is just a tool for mind action, using the principle of mind action. But I like how he said, training the eyes to see properly. And that's that whole idea that here, I've always thought it was interesting that Unity is in Missouri, which is the show me state on his license, which is the opposite of what Unity teaches. But it's all, you got to see it to believe it. Well, you know, Butterworth's whole point, and Wayne Dyer and all of them talk about we have to believe it to see it, because we see what we're conditioned to see. And so again, it's happening from the inside out. So our perceptions shaped according to our previous experiences, according to our faith, and according to where we are in consciousness, as he said. What you know, do we tend to see the universe as friendly, or do we tend to see it as hostile? All of those kinds of dynamics are going to affect how we see, and we can see that in our politics, how different people are hearing. I mean, candidates are saying the same things, and people are hearing what they want to hear from those candidates and interpreting what's good and bad according to their own experiences of the world and of life and of what the United States needs, et cetera. And it's sort of amazing to me to see how far, how differently we can perceive the same kinds of behavior, same kinds of comments. He also talks about, and think about this, when we see something in the outer that we don't like, our first tendency is usually to try and fix it out there, right? We try and change it out there. We try, what can I do to fix that? Who do I need to call? You know, this is sort of goes along with Marcia, with your idea too, of that we think about who do we call and all that sort of thing. And oftentimes we'll say, well, there's nothing I can do but pray, or we can just pray, when in fact, I mean, you bringing to it a consciousness that it's possible, it's going to happen, et cetera, is a huge...
That's what he... When we got off the phone, he felt it was going to happen.
Yeah. So that's a huge,
really
huge shift, yeah. So he talks about the first thing is, rather than fixing appearances out there, rather to set things right, as he calls it, that we need to see things right. We need to see it as it actually is in reality, and that maybe this needs to be adjusted, but realize that what's appearing is a reflection of our current consciousness. And if we want it to change, especially when it's our stuff, we need to change our consciousness.
Can you go either way? Can you work with the physical to try to change consciousness in some way?
I think we can develop habits, you know, work at consciously saying I'm going to do these things, and that can help change our consciousness. But the outer, you can't, there's a difference, I guess, between changing your consciousness, because your consciousness is what's ultimately going to reflect out there, than trying to fix what's out there. See, if your intention is, okay, so I'm going to set my alarm so I get up and meditate, you're using outside things to reinforce that you want to shift your inner consciousness, but you're not trying to, by doing that, you know, that's the malpractice. If we think, well, if I sit and meditate for 10 minutes, it means I'm going to, every day, it means I'm going to get a raise at work. You know, and we attach a behavior to the outer, as opposed to that it's just going to be better for me. So yeah, I think we can use outer to reinforce, but can you think of an instance where changing the outer changes your consciousness?
What I did this last week, when I've started to sit and eat, like, and if I don't, then I'm like, okay, stop. So this week what I did was I put a head, I have styrofoam heads that I've decorated, and so I put one nearby. So that, because I was aware that I was still thinking about work, even though I sit and eat, and I thought, oh my God. And
so, still not taking a break.
Yeah, I'm like, I'm feeding all this stuff. I'm thinking all this, and I'm eating. And so I had to like, so I did. I put a head on my counter.
What does the head do?
Well, it reminds me that I'm like.
Oh, is that your head?
Yeah.
Where are your thoughts?
I thought maybe it was company.
I was thinking company too.
That'll work.
I have these. I have these styrofoam because I use them for collaging. So I did that, and it's helped me. It's helped me just kind of be mindful of I'm not going to eat until I go clear out. So anyway.
What was an example of clearing out a closet? Physically clearing out probably could help clear out the mind.
Chatter.
Right? Chatter?
Mm-hmm.
Like that.
Yeah.
Could probably do that.
Right?
They're a little crunchy tonight. Sorry.
So if you look at it, the process, you've set an intention that you want to get rid of mind chatter. You started in mind. You went and cleared out a closet, knowing that that's a tool that might help you remember to clear out your mind chatter. That's different than you saying, if your life is crazy and chaotic, and you think, and I think this sometimes works, but it's hard for us because we're already so steeped in sort of going back to our mind. But if your life is chaotic and such, and so you clear off your desk, but you don't shift anything else about your life, you're not thinking, I need to get my life more in order, or you're not thinking, I need to clear my mind in order for my life to be in order, you clear off your desk. At least my experience, if I get into that kind of mindset, my desk gets cluttered again really fast. As opposed to if I'm...
Well, the clutter just moves over there.
Right, right.
There you go.
Yeah. Move it around the house. Yeah, kind of thing. As opposed to realizing that the reason my house is cluttered is because I'm not thinking straight, and my life is cluttered. So it's looking at what's a tool that's coming from consciousness versus a tool that you're trying to... See, again, I think we're so steeped in this now that it gets hard to ever think about doing stuff outside without being thinking about what's my intention in the process as well. One of the things I found really interesting, he said, having seen and felt the end, we have willed the means to the realization of that end. And he was talking about sort of self-fulfilling prophecy, that if we go, oh my God, that's going to be awful, it's going to be terrible, this is going to happen. And he said, if we really buy into that, we're basically helping create that very dynamic.
Yeah.
So I thought it was kind of an interesting. The other part of it is so expectations. When we have expectations, they have a lot to do with what shows up. Expectations end up being emotion tied with a visualization, tied with a mindset, and so that becomes a pretty powerful. And what we call self-fulfilling prophecies, which sort of is what mind action is, that all of our prophecies can become fulfilled. What goes along with that is not judging by appearances, but with right judgment. If we think that it's stuck, I guess the whole idea of saying, Lynn Twist talked about, so we have these three myths. One is, there's never enough. The next is, more is better. The third is, when this is the most difficult one, that's just the way it is the third myth, which sort of says, and there's nothing we can do about it, which takes away from all of our, and she talked about that's actually the most difficult one that keeps us locked in, because we take that, it's just a truth. Even if I wanted it different, even if I wanted to believe there was the fact is, this is the way it is. And so unless we can recognize where we hold those assumptions that is truth, those are probably the strongest ones for us to overcome, because then we think it takes literally the miracle that traditional Christians and such would call a miracle. It means some intervention that breaks the rule as opposed to fulfillment of the rule. You look like you're...
It just seems like it's such a... I'm reading it and I'm thinking about it somewhat, but to really notice all the times that I'm putting a limiting thought or using a limiting word when I'm saying something would really take a big commitment.
I had that same exact thought. I was like, oh my God. You know, you have to be, like, vigilant all the time.
Really vigilant.
And then I just,
you have to be vigilant.
Just becoming more aware of it is a big step.
And the thing is, you just have to be vigilant until you've shifted your perception. Right now, you don't notice it because you're living based on some other perception. So you do it enough that it becomes your worldview, and then you don't have to be vigilant. It's just, it happens.
Visual image we have comes to pass. I mean, that would be crazy. But it's the ones that are repetitive, you know? The ones that you think about all the time, you hear yourself saying over and over again. To me, those are the ones to focus on. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And to be aware of my language at all times, but especially if it's repetitive.
I can't do that because.
Yeah.
I can't do that because. Or I can't do that because. So that would be a repetitive thing that I probably would say to myself. Well, I can't do that because...
I think to really shift it, we have to get to the bottom of it.
Right. What's the underlying belief that's...
really the underlying belief? And if we really caught it in the moment, it would shift. Probably. You know?
You're talking about causality.
It would shift a little bit.
It would shift a little bit, at least. Yeah.
I think it goes both ways because, I mean, I've been doing this work for 20 years now, and I still catch myself saying things that are not in alignment with my beliefs. So some of it is just habit.
Well, some of it is the world we live in.
Right.
And so that's where the vigilance comes from.
Fighting against the drift of the culture, you know.
I mean, I'm fighting, I feel like I'm fighting just to notice that what I'm buying into, you know, what I have bought into.
But again, as you notice it.
More is better.
As you notice it, though, I just want to reassure you. Your life is probably very different now than what, and you may not notice it, but there's a whole lot of things that do shift. And I agree with you. We all make these comments. And it isn't about catching every comment. It's about catching, where am I living from? Where am I living from? And if you can shift that, am I living from that I have a trust in God, as opposed to that I don't, that I'm expecting things to go wrong versus that I'm expecting things to go right. There may be challenges, but I figure there. I expect there to be an answer, and I expect to, you know, that has more to do with it than any given little thought. That, and you'll find the more grounded you are in where you're living from, those other thoughts don't show up nearly as much because they're so in dissonance with your core understanding and how you're approaching life. Catching, and I think getting to the bottom of it can be something like if you, you know, we can affirm all we want that I'm a beloved child of God, and if we've got a belief going on down here that I'm not worthy, it's not going to.
Right, that's what's running.
Yeah, that'll keep running us. And the other stuff gets layered over the top, and we may be able to show up out here. But bottom line, our core, we're still living from not being worthy. And so that's why, you know, sometimes it takes counseling or figuring out until you can actually accept. You can't just put affirmations over the top of error beliefs that you haven't let go of.
And I would say there are warn against only mental processes. There are feeding processes.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the feeding processes, the feelings are happen in childhood, and they make a shadow across the present. So you're always living in the past. It's just like you're reflected something that's happened in the past because of childhood. So you can work those things out by feeling them. I mean, that's what I
right.
do. I'm not
embodied gestalt, and
I'm not much of a mental person, so I have to work in that way.
Well, I totally agree. Everybody needs to. Sometimes it depends upon your approach, but even if I tend to be cognitive, but that cognitive process has to also get me to feelings that I have, because you're right. The feelings may be deeper that, and oftentimes they're nonverbal, so you can't get to them with a cognitive process because they're a nonverbal experience that you had before you were speaking. So you just relate to the...
I'm dealing with that now. I'm wondering about some things that could have happened in childbirth or generational that are going through me. So, but I know that you can change that.
Yes. And you don't have to necessarily... I've come to believe you don't have to necessarily become conscious of what all those are in order to change them. You don't have to understand totally why.
No.
You just have to be aware that there's this feeling and it's not in alignment anymore with what I know to be true now. And so then you can begin to let it go.
Well, I know what you mean about the thing about not being worthy, because sometimes it's so easy to get to be excited about what you can do for someone else. And it's so clear, the path is so clear and so easy and it's so... set in stone, this is going to happen. But when it's about oneself, one doesn't feel worthy of, one can't get the same gusto of. That's what happens to me. I can't get the same gusto of, like, oh, it's all going to be fine for you. I can say it for someone else, but for me, oh boy. Get it, man.
Yeah.
I like to do a lot more than one thing. I like to work inside and outside. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the same as working with your feelings and your emotions. You know, we did this trust fall where we had to close our eyes and fall backwards into a bunch of guys' hands. And we were supposed to think of something that we were having issues with, trust issues with, as we were falling in the back of, you know. And I forgot to, actually I was thinking more about falling backwards. and I forgot to hold the thought that I wanted to, and I would, and I feel like my conscience would have shifted at least a little if I could have remembered to hold that thought while I was falling. So, yeah, I like to work anything that I could do that's more than one thing when I'm working on an issue, and I think that brings the feelings and the emotions together where they click, the consciousness clicks. Just
work
with more than one feeling.
Yeah, because we're multi-beings. We're physical beings, we're emotional beings, we're thinking beings, and we're spiritual beings. We have all of those facets.
I think if all those can happen at one time when you're working on something, or close.
Or you at least approach it from all those different directions, even if it's not, as much as you can the same time, and right, right.
As close as you can get to the same time. I think that's where the shift happens, quicker, if you can do that. I know that it can't always be done, because, you know, when I fell backwards, I made a sound nobody else did. I kind of screamed.
Well, then what you were dealing
some
with...
Didn't. Some didn't do it.
None of them did, but me?
No, no, some didn't even fall
some
backwards.
Some did fall backwards.
Oh, yeah. Well,
I know, yeah, I know. I had a chat with him.
And
oh. Okay.
But...
So I'm sure that.
I went backwards, but was forward before I landed in the arms.
Right, right.
There was no way I was going straight back.
So I would say that a part of you is saying, yeah, I wish I had remembered that belief. But you were just dealing, your core belief that was coming up is just trusting in the first place. Yes. So that was what was there to be addressed. So.
Oh, yeah. So that, yeah, a little bit. So that's my little first step.
Yeah.
And the
And the other issues, the point of that exercise is when you can trust and just go, the other issues are going to be resolved and or a whole lot more resolved because trust in and of itself is you trust life. Or you tend not, you know, there's this, we lean one way or the other. I trust other people. I trust life. If you come, if you're living from that, all these other little decisions reflect where you're coming from rather than whatever that decision is about. It has more to do with where, what you're living from than the specifics of any particular situation.
Right. Where you're coming from, that's the goal, is to get so that you can see the God and the good in everybody.
Right.
And that's the goal. That's one goal to have.
And not only see it, but expect to see it. I mean, again, our expectations are amazingly powerful in every way. If you expect something to be bad, you know, odds are, because I think I've shared before, I worked for a national grant where things just became horrendous. I mean, it was like freaky how corrupt and dysfunctional this agency was. Transferred over to a state agency that I wouldn't have, you know, I felt like I was being rescued out of this other one. Wouldn't have gone there otherwise. And it turned out to be, it was fine. And as I stood back and looked, it wasn't any better than that one. But my expectations were, I went into this grant thinking it was going to be just this fantastic, idealistic and all that sort of thing. And then what turned out was the opposite of that. Went into the state agency not expecting much. And so then it ended up being okay. So our expectations have, we live from, again, expectations are a good place, good way to check where am I living from. Because your expectations will reveal to you what you're, where you're living from.
Blessed is he who expecteth little, for he shall not be disappointed.
How would you then, from the expectation, I'm just thinking like the expectation versus the visualization, is this the expectation more an emotional?
Actually, so expectation is more mental. Okay. You create a mental construct of what you think this is going to be like. It may have an emotional component, but it's your intellectual visioning of, like she said, it's going to be an ideal place. That all these people are going to be all pulling together for the same cause.
Yeah, I'm just playing with the. I think it depends
because you can have, again, you could go back to some core beliefs stuff that determine your expectation, and they might be pre-verbal that you don't trust because before you could even talk. You learned there wasn't going to be anybody there for you, whatever, your life experience, mm-hmm. You formed some conclusion, which then creates an expectation. So that could not be a thought-through process. Other times, my job thing was very much an intellectual construct that determined my experience. So it would depend upon the issue you were...
I'm just looking at a visualization. Okay, you're creating... this image, whatever
For me, if I was doing a visualization, I'd be paying attention to what's coming up. Is what's
not
coming.
What you're expecting it to look like.
Well, because maybe I'm visualizing what you want, right?
Yeah.
So then I pay attention to these voices that are going, yeah, right. Or, yeah, those reveal your expectations.
Okay.
Okay, and then you got to say, something else is going on here underneath here that even though I'm visualizing this, I'm trying to lay it over the top of this swamp down here, that I haven't. And then you may not, again, you don't have to necessarily figure that all out or do psychotherapy. You just have to become aware of it and go,
aha moment.
Okay, so is that true or not? What do I actually believe? And you make a commitment to. So
we do that in education a lot.
Uh-huh.
Class, think about your class. You have a pretty rough and tumble class, right? I mean,
So,
what are your expectations?
No blood.
Get through a day without a window being broken,
a child being hurt. Yeah, that was just an overview question.
But no, I agree. I get it.
That becomes
no blood. Then,
but that also
no injuries, I should say. And so anything above and beyond that, I'm happy.
That,
I get to teach.
I mean, what you're talking about also, though, is how our expectations of other people also affect them. So our expectations of students affect how they show up.
But my expectations of students
very
much affect the outcome of whatever situation I'm in. It's not just, I mean, they could be the most, I mean, I'm a continuation school principal. I know what they can be.
Right.
But at the same time, if you have the expectation that this place is going to be a safe place, it's going to be this whatever, and that's your expectation, and I believed it in my heart, then if I started getting little second guesses, then that's the time I need to go, well, why am I second guessing this? What's getting in the way of that?
Right.
And is it because I'm afraid? Is it because I think I'm not good enough? Whatever the things are in there.
Those are all signs. So when we see the weapons of scarcity come up, we start paying attention. Do we see resistance? Do you see fear? Do you see, and so that's just an idea that we need to go a little deeper. So not judging by appearances is, again, saying, so whatever's going on out there, if I shift within me, then I'm not judging by what's going on out there. That's not going to be what determines it. I determine it. I'm going to bring meaning to this.
This sounds really corny, but I just find that if I'm always really nice to everyone, they're nice back. Even if other people say they're bitches or something.
Right.
They're not.
Right.
They're not.
Yep.
So it's what you put out.
Yep.
It's a moral reflection.
So the other thing you talked about is where we focus our attention. We've talked about that a whole lot. And he brought up the example, brought up the example of the TV is largely oftentimes a huge window that affects how we see the world. And it's what window you look out of. The example he gave, I don't know how many of you read the actual chapter, but he talked about the little girl she watched her dog being buried and then looked out the other side. And I guess if you're young enough, I was going, that's a little simplistic. but yeah.
That seemed like a weird example.
It did seem like a weird
example. Sad feelings that your dog died doesn't mean you're not having the right perspective. Like, this doesn't mean we don't have feelings.
Right, right.
Or we don't grieve things.
Right. So anyway, I thought it was about, but the metaphor of what window you look out does have a whole lot of whether life is good or bad. And if TV is our window, it can create lots of, in fact, that is what has created a ton of what our national perspective is. The fear of terrorists is all from the TV. I mean, think about it. There has been no terrorist attack out since 9/11 that has come in, and yet we're all afraid, and not only from news talking about all the places it's happening, but TV shows, the 24 and those kind of TV shows that I stopped watching. I remember watching 24 for a couple of seasons, just going, I am just filled with anxiety after I watch this show. I just don't, why am I bringing that into my life? Which is true about the news at some level too, that we can just, So prosperity consciousness, his whole point is having our centeredness being in God as the root of the reality within. That, and then we surround ourselves with what confirms that self-image as opposed to what challenges it all the time. So I realize I mean, most of you that come here go out into the world and work in other situations. My work is also this, and I purposely created that. I mean, that's why I wanted to go into ministry, to do this full time. So everything I was doing was reinforcing this, and I realized sometimes how skewed, because I don't understand people's responses sometimes. And I go, I live in a pretty consistent world with my world views. I don't have a lot of interactions with people that are hateful or in reaction, really strongly in reaction to things. So I'm grateful for that.
Yes.
Huh? Except for the television window, right? So can you think about ways that you confirm yourself, that you surround yourself with things that confirm your self-image? Well, that's true. If you pick a partner that, I mean, a lot of people are not with partners that confirm a positive image back.
I like a lot of little signs, stick-ups, little sloganeering, all the bumper sticker,
yep,
spirituality crap.
Yep.
I'm looking at those things all day long because they're attached to my computer screen and on the wall and so forth. That helps me many days. You know, I'll be getting into a tough spot and I'll look up and read something. Ah, yeah, you're right.
It just reminds you, for me, it just a reminder that this is just where your mind's going, and you can choose to have it go someplace
right,
else.
Exactly.
Is really powerful. So all of the little spiritual reminders, I've got them on my mirror and on my refrigerator and on my desk and beside my bed. And I remember when Kyle was going through his, in the midst of his major, I found this picture of him when he was in the second grade, and he was so cute and so innocent, and I taped it right next to my bed so that every night I looked and I affirmed who that was, that was still there, that core of innocence and purity was still in him. And I that was a piece of being able to hold on to that shift. So
I was going to say, I've got photographs up of my nieces and nephews. I've got one side of the family that has had a pretty rough time and have made pretty poor choices, and those kids grew up a whole lot differently than the other side of the family.
Right.
And I look at those kids and I think of the stuff that I did to make their lives just a little bit better during the times when they were at home with us.
Right.
And that kind of makes me feel good.
Yep.
You know, just seeing the pictures of, you know, me and the kids, you know, back in the, you know, the late 70s when they were little and didn't have a choice as to what was happening around them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they talk about for mm-hmm. how many kids one adult that believes in you can change a kid's life.
That's true. Yeah.
And it's a really powerful to choose to be that adult, and you can't weigh it by what you see happening. You just have to be that presence that's always holding the possibility. I was going to share this, that at Lent I started, this is how we can twist these ideas in our minds. You know, we can understand truth and yet still sort of get into the more is better self-image. And I've shared this, I think, before. I started the Only Diet There Is. It's this book about the only diet there is to love ourselves. And, you know, to affirm that. And I have, you know, affirmations on my computer and all that sort of thing. And I realized I did the same thing with that people often do with, you know, store up your treasures in heaven and the rest will be provided. So they go, oh, okay, I want the rest. So what do I have to do to be storing up stuff in heaven? I realized I started that to lose weight. So I set this goal of the only diet there is to love myself so I could lose weight, which meant I wasn't loving myself just the way I was, you know. And so you get like caught in this loop. And so for the last 6 months, I've been paying attention. The posters, the affirmations are still up there, though, and I realize all these beliefs have been coming up in me about that I don't look a certain way or I've gained weight, and what that has done to my, what that does to my self-esteem and what that does to my self-image. And I always said, well, I love my, there was a huge but in there. And can I, and it wasn't like a heavy duty condemning, but I can't meet someone unless I lose X amount of weight. I can't, no one will find me attractive unless I look a certain way. And all of these, I started seeing all the places comments made by various people just that fed those beliefs. And so it's been a real journey. I'm going, it's a good process that I went through because it's having the effect of learning to love myself, but in a different way. And in fact, I got to the point of saying, I'm not going to lose any weight until I really get clear. And I may not lose weight. I'm just going to get to a place where I feel good about myself. And so I'm starting to let go of that expectation. But so even as we're living these new thought and practicing these principles, our monkey mind will still come through and can mess it up. And so what do I want to be? Do I want to be a certain weight or do I want to love myself? And what's going to create more joy in my life? Wrong.
Just remember the kids' blessing. We love
you. Right, that's just the way you are. I know. So anyway.
I love that meme. I really want to lose weight, but I just love eating tacos. Which one's more important to me?
Well, that's what I started. I looked at all those things. I'm going, so if I really wanted to lose weight, I could eliminate this and this. Do I want to do that? No. No. And so it is, anyway.
I have a really similar thing. I was anorexic for years, so I was way too thin. And all of a sudden, I got over it. And all of a sudden, now I kind of have to lose a little bit. Wait, I've got this tummy. I mean, I hide it. I've got this big tummy. And even my family's like, wow, you've got this tummy now. Instead of saying, hey, you're over being anorexic, like, wow, that's funny. And I am thinking, I am going to love my tummy. Like when
yes.
I take a shower, I love, those old, real old pictures of ladies lying there. Yep. And they had tummies back
yes,
there.
Yes,
they were called Rubenesque. Because Ruben
well, and it used to be sort of normal. And then we have these, the images that we're, that we see are so unhealthy and so unrealistic and so, and then we're hearing on top of that, the meme in our society is that, two-thirds of us are obese, overweight, all of that dynamic and such, so we get all these messages, and whether it's for health or looks or whatever, there's a ton of, and so I have to go back and say, so what do I eat? I eat healthy and anyway, lots of beliefs that come through.
Yeah.
And anyway, I just thought that was funny.
That just made me think of something. One of my first graders comes in last week. Stocky little boy, both his parents are. And he comes in, and he refused to eat his breakfast. And it came lunch, and he refused to eat. And we're like, what's going on? And you could see this. The doctor had told him that morning that he was obese. And it hit him.
So now he's not going to eat, which isn't healthy either.
And so I had to sit with him, and we talked, and I said, well, let's, these are good foods we can eat, and, so let's take, and, I mean, it took a whole process, okay, no more chips,
right.
But let's have a carrot stick, or a broccoli tree, but he was bound and determined he was not going to eat because he was obese.
Which means his brain's not going to work.
Wow. I was like, choke that doctor, I'm sorry.
That's my point, but we're getting that whole...
It
whole
got
message.
This image in him that it's like, ooh, sad. Anyway, thank you.
But we don't want to have recesses in PE in school anymore.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, God forbid that we could have any activity going on in school.
Sitting in a chair all day.
All right. So, chapter 4 that we looked at is If You Can Believe, which all of these are the same extension of life happens from the inside out. What are our beliefs? What are we holding on to? I liked this affirmation. He said, right where I am in my present level of development, there is a limitless resource of wisdom and guidance, of ability and creativity, and of substance and supply through which I can do and do superlatively well all that needs to be done. So this idea of what we believe, and we can hold, that's checking into these affirmations we make, and I'm one that tends to make an affirmation that I can buy, as opposed to making one that I have all this monkey mind going, yeah, that, no, immediately as I say the affirmation, no comes up, and so I have to create an affirmation that I can accept, and then maybe progress from there, but so that we can, so I can own it, and it can start shifting the other thing I like is till up until now. So beliefs that we've had say, well, up until now, just as a reminder that I'm shifting. I'm in the process of shifting. So we already talked about expectations. The other thing I really liked, he said, a true desire is not to have, but to be.
To be.
I love that saying. That's probably one of the strongest statements in his book that talks about that the truth of prosperity consciousness isn't about having, it's about being, who we're showing up, what we're living from. And it's about unfolding into our wholeness, which doesn't have anything to do with what we have. So, any other thoughts about the readings, or?
It's a lot.
This has more reading than.
I mean, on the one hand, we say, like, with God, all things are possible. But that doesn't mean that, like, I'm going to go out and become a, you know, Olympic track runner or
right.
whatever. It's becoming who we are meant to be.
Right.
I underlined it. It's in there somewhere. But do you guys remember that part? It just,
yeah.
that was really profound to me about, like, we each have this, not like a destiny, but like this potential, this purpose, this thing inside us that is what we're supposed to be. And so it's about discovering and letting that happen rather than trying to go out and be something that I've decided is.
Well, the other thing he talks about, though, in there is, I recall, he was talking about like a pianist, a virtuoso pianist. Reality is most of us could do a lot of things, not everything, because we may not physically have the capacity and such. But it isn't a high enough importance to us to do that. So we talk about this pianist, and he talked about him being a genius. And he said, yeah, but before I was a genius, I worked really hard. You know? So it also takes that we make a commitment to something. And you don't get anything for free. So anything's possible doesn't mean I can just will it and just say, I'm going to be a millionaire and have it just show up. It means we would have to do the work. And so then that's where he talks about it gets really important to know what it is we really desire. What do we really want to be? Because if we set these goals out there that don't really fit who we are because somebody else has said we should do that or because on a whim, then it's not likely it's going to manifest because we're not going to do the work. If we wanted to be rich, we could make, you know, I could have gone into a different line of work. I could have done a number of things to make more money. That's not, wouldn't have made me prosperous because it wouldn't have been aligned with who I am. I would have had more money. That's all, you know.
I sometimes struggle with the thought that I'm still a loop of the same thing happening over and over again and not a possibility. So I wonder how much I've become a possibility and how much I'm still the same thing happening over and over.
A product of your conditioning as opposed to a possibility.
A product of generational stuff and stuff that happened as a child. Because those things tend to repeat over and over again. Different situations, different faces, different, but the same thing happens. So, but then I think you get to a point where there is a, if you've done enough work and processes like this and discussions like this, and you do become something more than a kind of like a loop of the same experiences. Because I see people over, I mean, I've dealt with it this last week. The same thing keeps happening over and over and over to people. And they don't know it. They're asleep. And either they don't want to get out of it or they haven't come to the point where they're saying, hey, the same thing's happened to me over and over again. That's when you can maybe wake up. So I kind of think,
or maybe they're waking up. If you saw the movie Groundhog Day,
oh yeah,
remember? I mean, sometimes they're, you know, it was like one little thing a day, one little thing, and so I have to believe that even if it's that it has to happen 99 times before we wake up, it's the 98th time. It's sort of Edison's thing of you know, I failed 1,000 times, but I didn't fail. It was 1,000 ways of learning, and yeah. So, and in terms of family dynamics, again, it becomes, so what philosophy are we holding? And And I always try and hold on to it, and I see the same thing, obviously. We can all see that, but if you look for where it shifts and grows, like what I tend to see is generations, we're in reaction to what we've grown up to, but that usually shifts us a little bit, and then our kids learn a little bit more, and then, you know, so there's always change and development going on. Doesn't mean awakening. Once we get awake, once we recognize what it means to be awake, then we recognize when we fall asleep. So for me, that's where consciousness really, that's that evolutionary process. And more people are becoming, what are they calling it now?
Super conscious.
Oh, when I did that comment on consciousness.
Oh, yeah.
It's like self. Right. We're like at the third level. So we're self-conscious just in terms of we have a consciousness of observing things, and then we become conscious of our self-consciousness, and then we become conscious of that whole dynamic.
Self-aware.
So that shifts. And once you've broken through to that once and are aware that that exists, then there's this, I don't believe we ever can go backwards. So there's always this pulling.
Well, I don't think you can stay backwards.
Right.
You can fall back,
sure.
But you
realize
where you are.
Right.
Whoa.
Or you realize you're not there anymore. So you're at least then.
Then you got the T-shirt. I'm out of here.
I don't think you stay back there long.
No, I agree.
In fact, there are people, I know that there's times that we kind of go, can I just go back to before? It seems simpler and you didn't have to be so accountable and such. And so I know the answer is no, you can't.
No, no.
You can't go back to where you were before.
You've crossed the Rubicon, as it were.
So anybody, those of you that read Lynn Twist stuff, she talked about the great lie and the surprising truth of scarcity and enoughness. It sort of fits into all the stuff we've been talking about. Were there any reactions or...
Which chapter was the one with the Mother Teresa story?
This one was three and four this time. Mostly because I'm trying not to have you guys have to read everything, and so we're looking at the chapters that actually, I think that one too had a lot more stories in it, so you can read them if you want, obviously, but the chapters that have like meat principles in it, yeah.
I'm so linear, I couldn't skip. I had to read it. And then, of course, I didn't finish all the reading. Anyway,
Basically, took the chapters that also the course outline. You know, so I changed the order because I didn't think they made sense in the order they put them in. But anyway.
No, this book is amazing. It's great.
Yeah.
Great.
So, you ready to do yours?
I got nothing.
Your video? You never have nothing.
Well, so I wanted to start out talking a little bit then about the big transformation and on the giftivism scale that we're taught about this week is the shift from transaction to trust. And so I wanted to spend some time talking about trust and gratitude and how they play in together and so forth from Eisenstein's book *Sacred Economics*, which, as you'll know, is the book that I'm really focusing on for this group. And I'm just going to sort of hopefully set a stage here for some things that at least some of you will be able to identify with. So, this is in chapter 21 of his book. In case you're reading it, which you're probably not, because she's giving you lots of other assignments, but. The question comes up again and again, how can I share my gifts in today's money economy and still get paid and make a living? And indeed, it seems like to charge a fee for material goods violates the spirit of a gift. The whole idea of gifting is not to charge for it. When we shift into gift mentality, we treat our creations as gifts to other people or to the world. It is contrary to the nature of a gift to specify in advance a return gift. for then it's no longer giving, but it's bartering or selling or something similar to that, right? On the other hand, it seems like we have that we have an agreement in our culture that the artist or the healer or the spiritual teacher providing us with spiritual gifts that seem to be belong to the universe deserves to be compensated for their work. And the problem with that idea turns out to be the word compensation. The idea behind compensation is that you have, by working, by providing this service, by providing this particular good, made a sacrifice somehow of your time for which you should be reimbursed. You have spent it doing work you could have instead spent on doing something you really wanted to do. And the problem with that idea, of course, is that in an economy that deserves the adjective sacred, which is the kind of economy Eisenstein is concerned with, the notion of work is no longer a matter of pain and suffering or sacrifice or loss. It's a sacred economy recognizes that human beings want to work, and that those of us who have gifts that came from the universe want to return those gifts to the universe, into the culture, into people in our lives. There's no room in that concept for compensation. This compensation is an offset to a loss or a sacrifice. And at its best, these kinds of things that we do are at least beyond price, even if they're not subject to the notions of compensation. No finite amount of money is sufficient in exchange for the divine. No finite amount of money is sufficient in exchange for the divine. But we sometimes wonder, well, so what is sacred work? What is sacred work that derives from this divine? And I think Eisenstein says we're all capable of sacred work, and all work can be sacred. He has a really good quote here that I've enjoyed sort of salivating over. Some things are too good to sell; we can only give them away. Some things are too good to sell; we can only give them away. So instead of asking, doesn't the artist, spiritual teacher, or whatever, right, yeah. Priceless. Instead of asking, doesn't that person deserve compensation, let's rephrase it. Doesn't the giver of great gifts deserve to receive great gifts in return? And the answer, insofar as deserves mean anything at all, is yes. In a sacred economy, though, that happens through the mechanism of gratitude rather than compensation. Exactly. So the point is that the idea of trust and gifting is tied up with gratitude. They are of the same cloth. To generate gratitude isn't your goal as a giver. It's a sign, an indicator that the gift was given well and met a need. Because we were talking earlier, we mentioned some of these things earlier. You could give somebody something, and if they don't appreciate it, don't acknowledge it, don't seem to be grateful for it, doesn't diminish your gift. It merely means you handed it to the wrong person, gave it to the wrong person, or in the wrong way or the wrong circumstances, to accomplish that closing of the circle with gratitude that we're talking about, that the great artist or spiritual teacher or whatever deserves. So he says, while it feels wrong to charge money for my work, it feels fine to accept money from people who feel grateful for having received it. Eisenstein, right? Yeah, because he gives away a lot of his stuff. His book is available free online as a PDF. You can download it, and then you can send him some money if you want through a donation, or pay it forward to somebody else who's doing something or whatever. Yeah. Yes, he is. He says, "Give me whatever amount or none at all that leaves you with a feeling of clearness, balance, and appropriateness, an amount that reflects your gratitude for my coming to be with you." That's what he tells people who want to book him as a speaker. So I don't charge a fee. I'll ask you to cover my out-of-pocket expenses, but I'm not going to charge you a fee. Just pay me what you think it was worth for me to be here with you. Now, to do that, you have to trust, right? Because you could easily be booked by a Fortune 500 company and walk away with a check for your hotel room. He says, as long as my gift intention is authentic, I find that the inflow of gifts matches or exceeds the outflow every time, as long as my gift intention is authentic. So that's the idea behind not trying to put a price tag on something. Not expecting, we were talking about expectations a minute ago, not expecting that there's a certain amount, minimum amount that your service should be worth, and if the guy doesn't pay that, then he's a turkey, or doesn't deserve you, or somehow dishonest, or not taking part in the process correctly.
I relate to that because I did that cross-stitch project, Namaste,
right.
And I donated that to the bookstore.
Right.
And when I gave it to Kay, she said, how much do you want me to charge for it? And I said, I'm giving this to the church. You can price it however you see fit.
Right.
And she priced it a lot more than I paid. I'm like, whoa, Nelly.
Yeah.
This doesn't cost anywhere near that much.
Or you could go the step further and say, it's yours to do with what you want, but you could just ask for a love offering,
right.
Which we we do. That's the whole idea behind a love offering, is that.
But he makes the point in here about love offerings. Is a good point. He makes the point in here that a love offering with no price tag, with no suggested price tag, is problematic for the recipient, not knowing what it should be.
For the donator. The one receiving the good, which is why we started.
Which is why we started our new. Years ago, we used to charge X dollars a class. Don't worry about if you can't pay it. Now we say a love offering of X dollars. Pay what you can afford, and if you can't afford anything, don't worry about it.
But we do a suggested amount. Right.
So you have a guideline of some sort. You can say, okay, you know that's what, and I know some people pay more than that, and some people can't afford to pay that much. It doesn't matter. The point is, at least there's a sort of a guideline set there. You can't use that all the time. That doesn't always work. So he moves into, in his chapter, the idea of gifting in the real world, in the world of business. And there are some really interesting examples here. And if we have time, I'll show you a somewhat lengthy video that I think you'll be quite inspired by. But I don't know if we may run out of time before that. He talks about some real world examples. For example, there's a clinic in Berkeley, a medical clinic called the Karma Clinic. We talked about the Karma Cafe last week in that other video. It's been treating people with holistic medicine on a gift basis for the last couple, 3 years. They get a bill at the end of a visit that says, your consultation is a generous gift from someone that came before you. If you would like to gift forward in that spirit, you can do so however you choose. Monetary or other gifts may be left in the gift box in the Karma Clinic office or mailed to, or you could give the money to somebody else you think needs it. Doesn't have to come back to us. In Ashland, Oregon, there's another gift-based clinic called the Gifting Tree has formed. Same exact model. They're doing the same thing. There are probably lots of other clinics around the country that we don't necessarily know about. But it's not limited to charitable organizations. Panera Bread, one of my favorite places. I just love that. I got a frequent eater card there, and I am one. But their St. Louis store operates on a pay-what-you-want basis.
And a lot of them do that at least once a week or something, too.
They have a sign in the store that says, take what you need, leave a fair share. They still have the price list there, but they're not keeping track of that, what you pay it for. And if that experiment works, and I think it has started to work, they're actually talking about expanding it in a number of their stores around the country. Now, the Internet is a really good example of a gift-based economy in lots of ways.
Apps and stuff say, you know, if you're inclined, send us a dollar.
Yeah, right. And a lot of software, for example, you can install a product called OpenOffice, which is a Microsoft Office equivalent software that will open and save Microsoft documents. And it's, for all practical purposes, it's basically a free version of Microsoft Office, which, as you know, costs several hundred dollars from Microsoft, is free, open source free. Nobody ever asks you for anything except that if you want to make a donation, they've got an organization that's maintaining it, and they'll be happy to take your contribution, but you're never required to pay anything for it. And a lot of people contribute to that organization, not with money, but with time, helping them find and fix bugs, rewrite documentation, provide samples, even do tech support for people who are using it. There are volunteer tech support people who volunteer a few hours a week to be online answering questions from users. a lot of bands are offering their music, and that's got to be a real rage since, who was it that did that recently, the big, huge one?
Taylor Swift.
Yeah, was that the one?
The one
she dropped some song that was...
She complained about not being paid for her music. Well, she was the one who was saying she did deserve to be paid.
Yeah, I'm talking about this. Not it's a one woman, one word name off a singer. Krista?
Beyonce.
No, not Beyonce. She's done that too, but this is a new one.
I'm sorry, no, I got
it. It's a one. The name of the song is like Peaches or Apricots or Lemonade. Okay, so
it's Beyonce.
Apparently, she had 190 million downloads of that song. 190 million copies of that song have been downloaded. I don't know how many of them were paid for, but they've been downloaded. And it was available free. That is, you know, there's a way for somebody who's in the independent music business to get their name really well known really fast by giving away something that gets a lot of traction in the free marketplace. I'd never heard of this one before. This is an interesting one. There's a law firm in Chicago, a law firm. Even the lawyers are getting in on the act.
No.
Called the Valorum Law Firm. And they send you an invoice for services. There's above the bottom of the bill, above the total due box, which is empty, there's a box that says value adjustment. And what they invite their clients to do is, here's the total bill for the month. Adjust it up or down based on how much value you think you've got out of what you think it's really worth. If we're doing a really excellent job for you, throw a few extra bucks at us. If we're not doing the job, take some off. If you don't feel like paying this bill, it wasn't worth it, don't pay it. And their whole billing system is built around that idea.
They're still in existence.
There's another one that I'm very familiar with.
If you got good service, think about it. If you got good service, you'd want them to be able to stay in business.
Yeah.
I mean, our orientation tends to be that if we feel like we got value, we are willing to pay for it.
And where's that place again?
Chicago. And then there's another one that I'm quite familiar with because I've used it to publish at least one book, and I've got three others in the pipeline through a company called LeanPub. If you're a writer, this is a good one to know about. They let the author set the price range on a book. You can set a price or you can set a price range. And the price range can be from zero to some maximum number, whatever that is. And the buyer who comes to buy your book doesn't have a price. There's no price set on it. There's a sliding scale, and your suggested price or requested price is indicated there. But he can move that scale up or down wherever he wants within the limits you set. I've got a book that I wrote that I'm writing called So You Want to Be a Writer. And I'm releasing it in a few chapters at a time. And I've got about 9 or 10 chapters out there. And I've only had a couple hundred people buy it. But I priced it at $4. $4 buys you the entire book when it's eventually done. It may be 6,000 pages before it's done. I don't know how big it's going to get. And I'm not making any promises either. It may be done now. I don't know. You pay what it's worth during that along this line, and I'll give it to you for free if you need it for free. So it's from $0 to $4 on the basis. Zero is okay. $4 is a requested price, as high as you want to go. And I've had two people pay $50 for the book. It's only got 25 pages right now. But I release two chapters from time to time and so forth, you know. So that's a model that's a new publishing pricing model that people are trying out. So that's another one of those gifting ideas. Let's find a way to make it not a transaction. So what's the difference between a transaction and a trust relationship? Gleaning from all these different sources we've talked about, transactions require an exchange or transfer of something between two people, but both people give something up to the other one. They require a medium of exchange. I don't trade you an apple for cleaning my house. I don't give you an apple for cleaning my house. I give you money for cleaning my house, and then you use the money to buy an apple if you want. Because there has to be a medium of exchange that levels a playing field, that's what the transactional basis.
Bartering would be a transaction because you would agree upon the value of the things.
But the medium
right.
is always an agree upon right. value that's right. abstracted from
so
those
you might
things.
Give a box of apples, right. But it's because you've agreed upon that it has an equivalent value. Right.
There's a one-for-one correspondence in a transaction. I give you something, you give me something. That means that the relationship or the transaction is reciprocal. So we each affect and influence each other in the way the transaction goes. The transactions are completely impersonal, or nearly so. The connection between the transaction partners is abstracted. It's not a question of being personal friends, although you may be, but that's not part of the transaction. The transaction is above and beyond.
In fact, we're told to keep the friendship out of it.
Yeah, pretty good idea not to have a lot of transactions with friends, for sure, yeah.
Or have them be very clear.
And finally, and this is really critical, the seller determines the price and has the final say. So I may set a price on something, and you may offer me X for it, and I may say, no, I don't want to take that much for it. If you don't want to give me this much, I'm not going to give it to you because I have it. So it's my, as a seller, it's my say whether the transaction happens or not. Okay, so let's contrast that with a trust relationship now. There is an exchange or transfer, as there is with a transaction between two people. But the goods and services are the medium. We don't need an intermediate, something to set the value. And part of the reason for that is that the correspondence between the giver and the receiver is not direct. It's indirect. I give you something. You may give me something. Or you may give something to somebody else who gives it to somebody else who gives it to somebody else. And the idea is that what goes around comes around. So I give something to you, and 5 years from now, I get it back from this other person who has no idea about this original transaction. That's happened in my life dozens of times over the last couple of years in astonishing ways. And I know it happens all the time to people who are in that kind of a mindset. And also the notion of a trust relationship is personal, even highly so. Because Eisenstein points out that if there is any genuine humanity at all in the business relationship, and when we're talking about a trust rather than a transaction, the person receiving the gift is as interested in making the person giving it whole as he is in receiving whatever it is he's getting. Because that human connection makes that possible, it makes that necessary. You don't want, if somebody gives you something, you don't want to shaft them. You don't want to hurt them. You don't want to injure them. You don't want to screw them out of something. You want to make that a fair relationship. And it's because of your basic humanity and humanitarian connection to that person that you want to do that. And the most important aspect of that is that the buyer is the one who sets the price and shares the final say with the seller or the giver. Right? Because I give it to you with no expectation of having anything, so you're going to set the price for it that you determine. You're going to determine not only how much it's worth, but how you're going to pay that back, in what form. You're going to give me something, if money or whatever it's going to be, or you're going to give it to somebody else, or you're going to hoard it, or you're going to put it in the bank and give it to me in 20 years when it's got interest. All kinds of things that could happen. But it's up to the receiver of the good, not the seller or the giver of the good, to set the price in that situation, because the giver doesn't set a price. Eisenstein makes the point that the payoff you get for living in the gift, he calls it living in the gift with a capital G, is that you become capable of the impossible. You become capable of the impossible simply by living your life in the gift. Because of all the doors it unlocks, all of the generosity and what generosity yields to us in our lives and so forth. So. Capable of the impossible.
So how does this concept, transaction to trust, fit with the principles we've been talking about? Fit with that we trust that there's an abundance of substance, unlimited amount of substance that we all have access to, that everything we need, we have
enough.
That how we see the world is how we experience it, and that life happens from the inside out.
Different kind of balance sheet to me. It's not one that you can figure out with numbers or keep track of, really, but certainly there.
Definitely reflects the sort of Jesus idea of you go out and you just trust that there'll be a place to sleep and there'll be food and there'll be, I mean, that's taking it to the extreme, but the, to me, this so lines up with, you know, it's so hard for us to get out of our money, the structure we're in. And yet if we talked about really living from principle, and this isn't saying that we have to do that, you know, like everybody needs to give away everything they have and such, but it's the idea of when we make it practical like this, it's more threatening than when we talk about principle, I think, at least to me. When we talk about principle, just trusting that there's always enough and all that sort of thing, we can sort of do that philosophically.
Well, that's fairly abstract.
Yeah, it's fairly abstract, yeah. And we can say, yeah, I sort of trust that, and yet I still function here in this, in the world where I get paid for what I do and all that sort of thing. So as we start moving to specific, which is what all of these folks are trying to get us to do, is actually start, so how would we shift our system so our system supported principle
generosity
and truth rather than scarcity?
Well, it's also, with this, there's I don't get any sense of having, it's not an accumulation, it's not a getting, it's it goes more with what I was saying earlier, that idea of what I have is my playland. It's like, this is it, and how am I going to be in it? So maybe I'll, you know, be a giver or a gifter. That's one way of looking at it in terms of how do I use the resources that I have and that come into my life and leave my life to care about, you know, care about people.
So the principle last week was consumption to contribution. So all of us tend to live about what we can get, collect, and we give, but we give in order to get a lot, not 100%, obviously. And this follows up on that. If we could shift to our whole orientation being about, what do I have to give to life? What do I have to give? I'm a contributor. I am a giver to life. And we focus on that and not on what we get. We just trust that what we need is going to come to us. Then it would be easier to move into this. That's the trust. You know, it's saying going from transaction to trust. So this starts making it very about, do we really trust that other people, and not other people, that life in general, because it isn't about trusting each individual. It's trusting, because it's sort of accepting that there'll be some that'll be in need and such, and I won't get something from them, but I will get what I need. Bottom line, I'll get what I need, and trusting that.
Like, how many of you, after last week's class, went to the website, sacredspace.org, which is where Nipunmeta was from, and signed up, set up for a newsletter, or registered as a volunteer?
Sacredspace.org. I didn't sign up. I looked at it and continued to be curious about it.
They have a really interesting process for volunteering. You fill out a profile that tells them all the things you're interested in doing and why you want to be a volunteer. And then you take a 40-minute video orientation followed by a 10 or 15-question quiz about their organization. And you submit that, and then they get in touch with you and tell you what projects are available that seem to fit your profile. And you decide which ones you might want to contribute to and so forth. They've got 500,000 people right now who are members of the organization. Over 100,000 of them are volunteers.
That was I realized that going into ministry was, in some ways, Rory used to always say he never thought that he would, you know, you serve and they're basically, my income, unlike civil service working for the state, which is what I left, is based on what people want to give. And if they don't want to give enough, then I don't, I mean, whatever, you know, but it basically, there is no guaranteed salary or whatever. It's just trusting that what that in serving God that, that there would be enough that comes back. And so it, it still has a little bit of, you know, there's an agreement and that sort of thing. And yet that agreement has been pretty loose, you know, and Spirit has continued to supply. So it's a, it's an interesting, you know, it, it's, I realize it's in the function of, I get like a monthly check and such, but when I step back and go, yeah, I was aware that I gave up civil service and all of that sort of thing. And I know the neat thing is my kids grew up watching that while there wasn't the kind of money that came in with civil service, there was always, always gifts, amazing gifts coming in. And they just, they've just learned to trust that in their lives too. They just, that's just what happens, you know. Had someone cut my hair and someone, you know, this various different kinds of gifts. So it's an interesting, I live with sort of one foot in each each world because I still have retirement and such. It's all part of systems and everything. And yet for 20 years now have, so, and it works.
So I had picked out two videos for tonight. We can't see both of them, but I'll give you a choice between them, or we can do neither one if they don't sound interesting. I'm not here to promote videos. One of them is about a 7-minute look at the Karma Cafe. A little more in depth, but it's really kind of a fluff piece entertainment kind of thing, where they interview some customers in the place and see what kind of reaction they get. You get to see the restaurant more and how it started out and all that sort of stuff. So it's a kind of a interesting historical profile piece. And the other is a 30-minute video, for which we obviously don't have time unless we run over tonight, that I found absolutely fascinating and incredibly inspiring, that talks about, well, Nipun Mehta, who's the founder of ServiceBase.org, is the ServiceBase.org is his wife, Pavi, is a tremendous public speaker, and she gave a talk at a conference called Wisdom 2.0 Business Conference in on the French Riviera in October of 2014, and talked about her family's business, which is the largest eye surgery clinic and hospital chain in the world. It was founded by her father, her grandfather's brother, who was an ophthalmologist. It turns out that there are 24 ophthalmologists in her family. She's about the only one who isn't one. She's a storyteller. And a very good one. And this video is about that business, but she weaves in a lot of the theological teachings around giving and generosity in the thing and so on. But there's also some interesting statistics, and so it's a really sort of case study about how gifting based business can be made to work at a fairly large scale, which I found interesting, but maybe very boring to those of you who aren't in the world of business and don't really give a crap about that stuff. So I'll leave it up to you whether we watch either or both of them. We can't watch them both, but either or neither of those.
I say we watch the new one, this last one.
Okay. So how many people wanted to sit through a 30-minute movie that's going to run us over until about 9:15 or 9:20?
I can watch part of it. I got to get out. I've got a teenager waiting to get.
Well, I mean, how many people are interested in seeing that, as opposed to I'll sit through it?
Can we get to it if we don't see it here?
I can send you the link for it. I mean, I could actually put it on our website too. So, I mean, if you don't want to take the time here, you can watch it elsewhere if you're really interested in it. Or we could watch the other one on the Karma Kitchen, which is, as I said, very short, much lighter weight. How many people want to watch the 6-minute one, 7-minute one?
That sounds like a good idea.
Okay, so not many people want to watch the 30-minute one. That's fine.
Right.
So we'll watch that one, and then if you're...
Before you turn it off, could I just put in a plug for the gardener? The gardener told me that he gave a homeless person $3, and he was driving down the street, and he was taking the same route that he usually takes, the gardener here in Harding. And something told him to pull over, and he had a strong urge, and so he pulled over. And then I don't know why he got out, but he got out, and right behind. Oh, we got out to look at the back of his truck for something. Right on the ground was a $5 bill.
Oh, cool. What goes around comes around, right?
Yeah. Trust her.